The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to another one of our Urbanite radio stories. Today we are bringing to life the Q&A that you have read in this September's issue of Urbanite magazine. We're talking with Dr. Robert Balfonz, got your name right, don't I? Who is a research scientist at Johns Hopkins University at the Center for Social Organization of Schools and other places as well there. His focus is on the dropout crisis that Baltimore City faces and the nation faces with our students in public schools. And Robert, welcome to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
So this is a such an all and kind of consuming, encompassing kind of issue in many ways. I mean, the way you seem to approach your work and that many people in your world approach their work is beyond schools.
Mm-hmm.
We always look at things as a school crisis,
right,
a school problem, but the way you approach it from the beginning, from Jump Street, as they say, is a larger social context.
Right. So yeah, that essentially what we came to realize is that it's a community problem, and especially it's the community that bears the cost of the dropout crisis. When kids drop out of school, they stay in the community, and since we know in America there's really no work for a high school dropout, what that means is we have large numbers of 18 to 24 year olds who are simply idle. Officially idle. In reality, they find other things to do. But it leads to very high costs for the community. And until the community gets involved, we're not going to solve this with the schools alone, although they have a critical role to play.
I want to come back around to that because I think that when you do studies like you have done, others have done on the dropout issue, that the larger social context kind of defines for us that it's impossible for schools just to address this as a school issue.
Mm-hmm.
But you have written about a lot of things, and one of the things that I think that people always talk about is that we have to look at the percentage of kids who enter the ninth grade,
right,
and do not graduate the 12th or graduate years after,
right,
or never graduate,
right,
at all.
Right.
It seems so difficult to put their hands around that for some reason.
Yeah, it's been a struggle, but I think we're finally getting it. The National Governors Association and finally is leading the way on this, and the Department of Ed has enforced it. So in a few years, all states will at least have accurate counts of who graduates and who drops out. That, of course, is just the very beginning baby step. At least lets us help locate the problem.
So what has been the problem with something that seems so simple to do? You would assume it was so simple to do.
The challenge is that very few kids announce I'm dropping out. They don't walk into the principal's office, say, I've had enough, I'm out of here, see it, I'm never see you again, good luck. They just stop showing up. And the schools don't know what happened to them. And it was sort of in everyone's interest to have a positive attitude. So the famous statistic used in many places is whereabouts unknown. And it was assumed if your whereabouts were unknown that you went somewhere good, so we don't have to count you as a dropout.
Right, you move to the county, you move to another state, you move
right,
someplace else, right?
Right. And so it was only – and it was to everyone's advantage to sort of minimize the problem because they didn't feel they had a solution. They had a lot of pressure to raise achievement scores. You can only do so much at once. And so there was sort of a gentleman's agreement to minimize the problem. But we realize now that has a huge cost for society, so we have to confront it.
So when you and others hear that X amount of students enter the ninth grade, but only a much smaller X amount of students graduate, right, what is it in Baltimore for a long time? It was like some people assumed 25% of kids who came into ninth grade actually graduate. Some was a little higher.
Yeah, it's actually gotten better over time. It's still not great, but there has been improved. In most major cities in America, it's between 50% and 60% of kids don't graduate. Between 50% and 60% of kids do graduate.
Now, but if you take out of that, and we're talking about urban schools,
right,
and urban is always the code word for black,
right,
students or Latino students,
right,
or students who live,
right,
in poverty.
Right.
So if you look at urban schools,
yes,
what does that statistic tell us? Is it higher?
It tells us that in urban schools, often the majority of African American Latino students don't graduate, or perhaps the bare majority do. But it's for many of them a 50-50 proposition.
And when we're talking about, I mean, you know, these statistics can always kind of be almost not inhuman, but they can separate us from like humanity because they're just numbers that we see, right?
Yes.
So how many millions of children are we talking about that you think are affected by this in the United States of America?
The basic estimate is about 1.2 million kids drop out every year.
Every year?
Every year. And so people have done the statistics. That's one every, you know, 18 minutes. And a good friend of mine, the former governor of West Virginia, argues that if we heard on the news that 500 kids disappeared today, we'd be up in arms. It would be a national crisis.
Right.
There'd be 24/7 media coverage. But in fact, that many kids do disappear every day, quietly and unnoticed.
And it is not... And it's a pattern, I think, for our country in many ways. That, I mean, if hates always come down to this, but sometimes it does. Mm-hmm. That we're talking about 500 kids who are mostly non-white children in America who get lost every day, and there are white kids too who live in poverty who get lost as well. But we're talking about people from the underbelly of the society, from the poorest sections of America that disappear. And we don't see those poor sections, so we don't think about it.
Right. That's why it's often called a silent crisis, because in many parts of America, everyone graduates from high school, and the big stress is how good a college are you getting
into.
Whereas in urban areas and also low-wealth rural counties, which are also the unknown parts of America.
Speaking of West Virginia.
Right. Graduation there often is not the norm, but because we have such intense residential segregation that those two communities rarely ever interact. And so one doesn't know about the other, and therefore it doesn't seem like a problem.
So, and again, as we wander away into the kind of the heart of your text and work and your research, because community is such a huge part of what you come up with at the end of your studies, a part of any kind of change sometimes, and you said the hidden, the invisible, 500 children a day that go missing in America, dropouts. If they were a political force, knew how to cross lines, you know, if black folks in Baltimore could cross lines with Latino folks in Houston and white folks in West Virginia, I mean, that's a different force that could make a voice heard.
Yes,
because it's their children, which are really our children, that are missing.
Right. There is a coalition to be made there. I mean, there is from the sort of rural South and urban North, actually has a lot of senators and a lot of congresspeople. And that's actually – there's gaining some traction for some federal help for this, and that is that reason. They realize there is a broad-based coalition to be made at both the local and then up to the political level.
Because, I mean, when we think of dropouts and kids getting older, we often also think of the older a kid is, they're less attractive to be sympathized with. You know, it's like – I hate to put it in this level, but it's the difference between – a furry animal being extinct and an insect.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? That's...
Well, I mean, and also what happens is, and it's because of the lives they lead and the difficulty of living in poverty, you have to develop attitude to survive. And so it isn't, you're right, it isn't a bright-eyed five-year-old. It's a sort of surly-looking teenager.
Right. And we've all had those in our lives.
Yes. And so you're right. It's much more easy to say, well, I don't see much effort from you. What am I supposed to do? If you don't want to graduate from high school, how can I make you graduate? And if your parents don't support you, what can I do? And that does lead to this sense of that no one's responsible and no one can make a difference. When in fact, when you talk to dropouts, they almost instantly regret it. I mean, that's one thing that's hopeful about this. It's not like people think dropping out is cool. You get an exciting life instead of going to a boring school. They're frustrated. They're feeling alone, but they quickly realize it's not better on the other side. And they also get there's no work. And so many do try to come back. Some succeed, but it's often very hard to come back. And they often will say, if one adult had just said, don't go, I would have stayed. Now, you take that with a grain of salt because they are surly teenagers. But it does say that there is room for impact. As I always say, it's not like smoking or drinking. Like it's inherently pleasurable. We got to tell them it's not good for you. They sort of get that it's not good for themselves. But they often feel they have no choice.
That's funny. Not funny, but it's interesting you say it the way you said it, because I think that there are many people who would not assume that or don't know that.
Yes.
You know, that these are wild kids who look for their freedom outside the doors of the school.
Right. And that's a small percent, but, you know, or kids that get pregnant or the kids that have to work to support their families. That's all true, but if that was the only thing, we'd have a problem, not a crisis. Mm-hmm. When you routinely have half or more of your kids for decades, really, dropping out of school in certain communities, that's a crisis. And really, those are kids that are, in a sense, not succeeding in schools, and the schools aren't succeeding in helping them succeed. And they basically – and what we found, it's very mechanical. You know, you miss a few days of school, you fail a course, you fail enough courses, you don't earn enough credits to get promoted – you try again. Very few kids drop out right away. They actually try to repeat the grade. Nothing's changed. Same scenario. You fail again. Maybe a short stay at an alternative school and you're gone. It's a very mechanical process, so and hence very knowable and very predictable. And that's what a lot of our work has shown, is that as early as the sixth grade, the kids are actually raising their hands and waving, saying help. And we haven't either chosen to pay attention or we haven't known the signals to look for.
So you I love this one line in one of the things that you wrote, which is a very short line, but it just jumped out at me. It said, by and large, this year's dropout is last year's truant.
Yes. And that speaks to this dropping out is usually not a sudden thing. It's not I got mad at my teacher, mm-hmm. gone. It's that I'm disengaging from schooling and I'm not finding a way back and I'm struggling and I'm failing and I'm not enjoying my classes. They're not interesting to me. I'm not getting along with my teachers. And so your first response to that is just to skip a few days of school. And typically what happens is you learn nothing happens. No one really outreaches to you. No one says, where were you? No one says, how can we get you back? Or if you don't come back, something's going to happen. So you skip a few more days. mm-hmm. And eventually you sort of have one foot in, one foot out. And then in the meantime, though, school is going on. So now you're going to fail everything. And so now you realize you failed all your courses. They're going to ask you to go repeat the grade again. And then you just don't come back after the summer. And that's why it's really important for us to pay attention to chronic absenteeism, because it really is this early indicator, the canary in the coal mine,
right.
that says that, hey, we better do something. And also on its own, I mean, kids should be in school, right? I mean, we have to work to make schools better, but even with their struggles in a high poverty neighborhood, a school is still the best place to be. You know, as long as you're not having a tough – you know, a few kids have a very tough situation in school. They're actually being bullied or a teacher is being unfair to them. But absent that, it's much better to be in school than on the streets. And we really have to, you know, really push to say everyone should be in school every day.
It's funny. I was thinking about what you were just saying, and I could see that maybe a subtitle for one of your reports should be The Disappeared.
Yes. Yes, you know? Absolutely.
You talk about why students drop out You have four kind of areas, kinds of reasons. You write about life events, fade outs, push outs, and failing to succeed.
Yes.
Talk about those categories and where those came from and what.
Right. So one of the things that we found was really important to show people this is not intractable is to give them a sense of who are the different types of kids that drop out, because each requires a different intervention. And it's important for communities to know how many are in each bucket, because they do. And both by our personal experience and looking at the research, we said that four categories really jump out. The first is the one we all sort of know, which is life events. You get pregnant, you get arrested, you have to work to support your family. Life intervenes. That turns out to be a relatively small number of kids. Mm-hmm. But they require a different solution, right? You got to find them work. You got to deal with being pregnant. You got to get them out of jail and back into school. The next group of kids are kids that sort of fade out. They actually make it to 11th or 12th grade. They don't stand out as a behavioral problem, or they're not really failing classes. They're sort of on no one's radar screen, and they just stop seeing the point. They don't really get a sense that whether I get a diploma or not will change my life. I'm older. I'm getting a little bit frustrated, and let me go try being on my own. It's sort of the exuberance of youth tied in with the alienation of youth, deciding mm-hmm. to go on your own. Again, a significant but not the overwhelming number. Then there are some kids that, if we're honest, are pushed out. They're seen as a detriment to the school or to other kids. Maybe some places we think we won't make AYP because you're here, or you know, you're in the office every day. You're getting in fights every day. We're spending all our time dealing with you. You've turned 16 or 17. You can now legally drop out. You've missed 10 days in a row. We'll use our administrative rules and push you out. And that, again, really varies, and it really depends on the knowledge and will of assistant principals when it comes down to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, the biggest category is kids that are failing to succeed in school, and the schools are failing to give them the supports they need to succeed. So these are the kids we talked about who are miss a few days, start failing courses, don't get promoted, try again, nothing changes, same scenario. And essentially, they come in with lower skill levels or weak motivation. There's some kids that come into high school with okay skills, but still the motivation, the disengagement starts. They miss school. They still fail courses. But the positive thing is this group is the most predictable and B, the most reformable. Because it says if we get you early, if we keep you on track, if we make school engaging for you, if we make sure you get the help you need to get onto grade level, those kids will graduate. And since they are the largest number, that gives us a sense that we can actually make a big difference if we have a focused effort.
So now one of the things you tackle here, though, is the problems inside the schools themselves.
Yes.
That the places where we need in urban schools the most help is the places that we have the hardest problem keeping professionals inside. You said
yes.
In one of your reports about the ninth grade as being one of the most undesirable
right.
teaching assignments for any teacher. And then if you add inner city to that title of inner city middle schools,
right.
then it becomes a place you may be assigned to because you're a new teacher. The older, best teachers are somewhere else.
Yes.
And you do your best to get out of there and get into a high school.
Absolutely.
So we have a problem of how do you staff
yes,
the most needed places.
In many levels, the dropout crisis is socially created because think what we've done. We've taken our neediest kids and through residential segregation and other means concentrated them in a few places. Those places, they then go to a school that's treated like any other school as far as staffing and resources, which is that we try to get everyone gets equal. You have the same teacher ratio, the same counselor ratio, the same assistant principal ratio. But your needs are five times higher than the school 10 miles down the road from you in the mm-hmm. suburbs who gets the same base resources. And then on top of that, you actually get less resources because you get the youngest, least inexperienced, most transient teachers. So we create an infrastructure of sand upon which we're trying to meet the most neediest kids. So instead of like sending the Marine Corps of Education into the toughest places, we essentially send the rookies, right? And those that can't find work elsewhere. And so we are putting the neediest kids with the weakest adult resources, and we don't have enough adults even to meet the scope of the problem. So we shouldn't be surprised that year after year, the school produces a lot of dropouts.
So can a school system address that? Are places addressing
yes.
that?
Yes.
We're still living in Baltimore now.
Yes.
We have a new CEO. Is that
yes.
being addressed at any level?
Yes. I think in a number of places, and what's amazing is some of the places that people would have seen as the most intractable, like New York, Chicago, and Baltimore, are some of the places that have thought the most deeply about this recently and are showing signs of having the most comprehensive solutions.
Mm-hmm.
So in Baltimore, for example, the idea to open up 24 new 6 through 12 schools, which are new schools with designs, with external operators to provide support, and the 6 through 12 grade span, which is important. So we can take you while you're still engaged in schooling and create a good place for you to stay.
I want you to explain something about
yes.
this. When we look at number of kids leaving schools, mm-hmm. and we've seen over the years, as teachers love to call it, the flavor of the month, things
mm-hmm.
are – some philosophies changing about how we should
yes.
approach our kids every
yes.
year. One of the biggest things that frustrates teachers is that,
yes.
I think. So you've got that, and we had junior high schools, and all of a sudden we have middle
yes.
schools.
Yes.
And now we're talking about, okay, we shouldn't have separate high schools and middle schools. We should go 6 through 12.
Right.
So talk about the logic for that. I mean, why is that all of a sudden a superior model?
Well, the truth is there's different ways to do this. But what you're trying to do is to create smaller personalized environments for kids where we don't have this enormous number of needy kids and a limited number of adults that don't want to be there. So as it turns out in Baltimore, you can clearly see from the data that our large middle schools were essentially – educational agents of destruction that we put many kids right at the point when they were making independent decisions to be engaged in school or not, 11, 12, 13 years old. At the same time, they have a strong pull of the streets pulling them in. We're putting them all together in under-resourced middle schools in high numbers with very transient teachers. And if you look at the data, those schools produce the highest number of chronic absenteeism. They produce the highest number of kids who eventually don't graduate. And so we've seen in Baltimore, with both an earlier effort to create K-8s and a more recent effort to create 612s plus charters, that there's been a significant decrease in chronic absenteeism in sixth grade, from about a third of the kids to about a fifth of the kids.
In which schools?
The citywide.
The ones that have gone through, that are smaller?
So attendance is better in K-8s versus the old big middle schools.
Uh-huh.
It's better in the charters, and it's starting to be better in the transformations, which was just gets to the point that the 1,000-student middle school was just about the worst design. Now, you can debate what the better design is,
right.
But my feeling is that the improvement is getting rid of the 1,000-student middle school is the step forward.
And these transformation schools are something new that's come to Baltimore under Dr. Alonso.
Yes, yes.
And they are basically...
The basic idea is to create a school that's about 75 kids per grade that goes from 6th grade to 12th grade. So they take them right when their kids are making this independent decision, am I engaged in school or not, and get them all the way through to graduation in one place. So you can create sort of a one family known atmosphere. And by only having 75 kids per grade as opposed to 300 in a big middle school, it's a much more manageable number of kids per grade. And then they also have external operators or partners, which brings additional capacity and different ideas and different focus.
And the critical word you use here is engaged.
Yes.
Yes. Engaging the students.
Yes.
Which is something right. Is, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Because what happens is that when you think about it, it is when you're 12 or 13 years old that you make an independent decision to be engaged in school. When you're in elementary school, you go because your mom pushes you out the door, because your teacher is bright and friendly, because all the other kids are there, and you're still at development of the age that you sort of do what you're told.
Mm-hmm.
When you turn 11, 12, 13, you're developmentally making an independent decision, is school for me? And you're also learning that you can put on the mask. You can say, yes, sir, and be somewhere else.
Exactly.
And so we need to recognize that and say that at this age, they're actually not going to just go there because we tell them. And also, they have the wherewithal, and it's enabled in a big city by mass transportation. They're now taking the city bus to school. They're often taking city buses with transfers. Well, your mom or whoever, your grandma can put you on the bus. You go to that transfer point. You and your buddies can go left, not right. And there's no one at the school saying, where are you? They're not checking kids in at the door as we would. And that's just a difference we recognize between urban areas and suburbs. In the suburbs, the yellow bus picks you up at your front door and drops you off in front of the school building. There's no escape. You might not like it, but
right.
You have no opportunity not to get to school. And big cities, and Baltimore's not alone, it's any major city relies on mass transportation starting in middle school. A, it gives kids skills. I mean, not many suburban kids at 12 could by themselves do 3 bus transfers. That would be a terrifying prospect to many of them.
Right, right.
So
right.
You've developed a certain skill set and independence, but that also provides opportunity. And also to leave school in the middle of the day, right? If you only have yellow buses, you have to walk a couple miles to get home if you leave school. In the city, out the back door, onto the MTA, and you're
wherever you want to be.
Wherever you want to be. Which is, again, to get to this other point, that's a sense of adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to recognize that. That's a huge middle grade need also, is to have, we say, adventure and camaraderie. And if we don't supply that in schools, kids will find it outside of school.
And one of the ideas that that people are talking about, that you've talked about and written about, is that the idea of eliminating and cutting back drastically on the number of dropouts in our urban schools is more than an immediate problem of identifying a sixth grader or identifying a ninth grader, the two key grades where you can tell where people are going to drop out or not, that you talked about, but is something – it's a approach to reform that goes pre-K to 12 in order to really address the issue. You can't just address it by looking at the immediate problem in 6th and 9th grade.
Right. Right. It's both. You have to make – those are sort of the emergency exit gates, and you got to have strong fight things against them. But then you have to stop the flow out those gates. And so that's really why we have to have this sort of continuum. And what we've really found is it's the key transition points. I mean, kids that make a transition into school well, from pre-K to second grade, both the skill level but also learning that learning is joyful, right? Again, because this gets to the personal commitment again. Sometimes we're so nervous about the skills of entering young kids that it becomes so regimented. you know, learn, or else.
Right.
That the kids say, this is God, this is an awful place to be.
I want to be here. You know?
I'll go because you're telling me, but as soon as I have an option, you know, I'm going to look for it. So we have to remember that always, yes, we have to develop skills, but we got to develop engagement and passion and desire. That because it, really, the crazy thing is, as we all know from personal experience, when we actually learn something we care about, that's a joyful, exciting thing. That's not like, all right, that was hard. I did my exercise, and now maybe life will be better. It's like, that was cool. Mm-hmm. And so we've got to keep that in mind. And then they have to, you know, clearly learn to read, right? We can't minimize that. If you don't read by early on, you're going to always struggle. Then we have the middle grade transition and high school transition and then the transition out of high school. We can't drop the ball there, right? We can do all this, get them to the end, and then say good luck. And what we're learning, right, again, is that the transition from high school to post-secondary, there's very little guidance. And in fact, what we're learning is to get kids to graduate in higher numbers, we need more structure. We need to have, you know, there's one curriculum, there's three levels of extra help, there's four adults looking out for you. You know, you can screw up twice and we'll still get you through. And then we're saying, good luck. Get to that community college on your own. Figure out how to get to Baltimore County. Figure out how to work and take those courses. Figure out how to study, you know. And that's the reason we see that even if we get kids to graduate, many of them don't make it past the first year of post-secondary.
One of the experiments in the city here and around the country are KIPP schools.
Yes.
Some of the model you're talking about sounds like a KIPP school.
Right. Work hard, be nice. With lots of support.
With lots of support.
Right.
And checking attendance. And
yes.
Going to kids' homes if they don't know why you're not here. And actually at this point starting to pick up and drop kids off to get them to and from their schools.
Yes. That's what it takes. I mean, that's not the only model. The community school model, one done well in high intensity, is also like that. But it is the recognition that this is the cutting edge of the battle against poverty. And poverty, concentrated poverty, is a tough opponent. And these kids are very fragile. And the thing that you have to realize is that you can even make success and you think you're on your way and something can come out of the life of the neighborhood and knock that off course. And so the sort of constant vigilance needs to be provided to say part of our job is to create a pathway out of poverty. And to do that, we've got to do both this strong academics and engage you and provide the social support. And then we have to recognize we're asking three times as much work out of teachers. So we have to reorganize their work. So this is not just like, oh, and by the way, after you've done your busy day and done all your lesson planning, call 10 kids.
Right. All right.
Right.
People don't realize how hard teachers work, I think, sometimes.
Yeah.
And I think the picture you paint is important. I think that somehow we have to paint this picture in a larger canvas for America.
Right.
Because we talk about the image of street smart, tough inner city kids. Mm-hmm. And what you described, that could have been a throwaway sentence, but I know you didn't mean it that way, but is that we're talking about very fragile kids in a tenuous existence.
Yes.
They're almost contradictory, but they clearly are.
And that's what greatly complicates us, right? Because they will put on the external toughness to you, which could be a turnoff to many adults. Mm-hmm. And what they don't realize is that behind that, there is this very fragile and in many cases, unimaginable existence that's so outside of a basic middle class lifestyle. And even right here's the other thing. Any teacher in a school has a college degree, which makes you by definition middle class. Even if you came from working class or poverty, you've still made it out of that to the middle class. And you have that more of a middle class day-to-day existence. In high poverty neighborhoods, some of these kids just go through incredible struggles every day that you know, they're living on couches. They're living on their own. I mean, a high percentage of high school kids are essentially raising themselves. And it's just a very different existence. And one thing that drives the kids crazy, and it's so hard because sometimes they're telling tales and sometimes it's a real tale. But, you know, if they've, you know, something happened that just something that made it impossible for them to complete their assignment. And the teachers are like, you know, we don't really believe you because kids tell tales. Then that kid gets insanely frustrated, right? Because they just had to go through this huge family crisis. And now the teacher's getting on their back because they didn't do their assignment.
Right. And it's very hard for those kids to address all that at once.
Yes.
So one of the things you say, some of the prevention things you're talking about. Mm-hmm. You talk about on one level, I'm going to say a couple of things here. One is don't expel primary school students.
Yes.
Don't. And that's becoming a...
Yes. That's one of the things sort of flabbergast you. You would think that would be the biggest no-brainer. You're a four-year-old and we're going to expel you? Right? We have to educate our four-year-olds. And it's sort of on... It's free public education, right? We're not supposed to be able to pick and choose who we educate. Yet it's in some places it's a growing trend. You know, we can't handle your behavioral outbursts. Go somewhere else.
So what does the school do? Because that happens a lot in a lot of inner city schools. You have a lot of very angry, frustrated young children.
Well, and
who
this
will do
is
things from
right.
throwing chairs to cursing at teachers.
And this is where the community's got to step in and say, we have to resource you. That's a real problem. We can't say to you, too bad, deal with it. Because the teacher's point is valid. I have 15 kids. This one kid will take all my time. And I won't teach the other 14. Is that reasonable to you? At that level, it's not. But we have to invest community and external resources to provide the social worker, the family intervention, the more structured learning environments to get that four-year-old to be able to socialize into the norms of schooling.
So you also talk about – this is an amazing statistic here. And I'm not sure if you're referring just to inner city urban kids or if you're talking to kids in general, but and you'll tell us.
Right.
But you write in one of your papers, for every 100 sixth graders who fail math or English, only 11% graduated from the school system on time, and only 27% within 2 years, two extra years.
Yes, that's just is for high poverty neighborhoods.
Okay. So
and again, that's one of those things that just flabbergasted.
It's amazing.
That again, these are these 12-year-old kids, and why would just failing math when you're 12 sort of be the end of your educational career and in some sense minimize your life greatly? But think about it. If you're 12 years old, it takes a lot to fail sixth grade. Teachers are forgiving. If you mess up but do better, they'll say you're improving.
Mm-hmm.
If you had a hard time but you're showing that you're coming around, they'll give you a break. High school teachers won't. You fail, you fail. You got a zero, we average it in. But middle school teachers will. It's hard to fail. So if you're failing math, it means either one of two things. One, you're getting like zeros on all your tests, which means you really are behind multiple years
you're
in
not
your academic
getting it
knowledge.
For whatever reason.
Or you are really acting out or you're missing lots of school. And absent intervention, what's going to change that? If a 12-year-old – and again, this is stunning. There are 12-year-olds who are missing 40 days of school. If you're 12 and you're missing 2 months of school, absent intervention, how does that change? It gets worse. If you're misbehaving, how does it worse? And those things just accumulate. And what's happened is we want to believe that they'll grow out of it. This is early adolescence. It was a turbulent time. We all hated it. We all have family stories of people being really off the hook at 12 and growing out of it. But in resources places, maybe we got them a tutor. Maybe we took them to a psychologist. Maybe we had an uncle intervene and take them under their wing and say, settle down, young man. High poverty neighborhoods don't have those resources. Their resource is the school.
Right.
And if the school doesn't have a solution to that, there isn't a solution to that. And if we ignore it, it just gets worse over time. It doesn't get better. And now what we did find is in sixth grade, they're usually just failing math or English. Very few fail both. And they may not be coming to school or they may be misbehaving. It's not both. By ninth grade, that kid is failing everything, not coming to school and misbehaving. And so, again, that's the importance of these middle grades to keeping kids on track is not to ignore these early signs. And if you do, we see these astounding statistics. And we've now done this in about 10 cities. So it's not even just like one bad city, one bad year.
These are fairly universal statistics.
Yes, that kids that struggle in the sixth grade, that just in middle school, absent intervention – essentially, one in four will graduate. Yeah.
That's a frightening statistic.
And then the other thing that we found it makes it even worse, and then we got to get some up stories here
to
how we solve it, is that in Philadelphia, we were able to cross-reference school records with social service, abuse and neglect, juvenile justice records at the individual level, which we need to do more of, but was rare. And what we found, and this makes sense when you think about it, is that two-thirds of the males that got arrested in ninth grade and two-thirds of the females that got pregnant in high school had a sixth-grade off-track indicator, which again says by ninth grade they've struggled now for 3 or 4 years, and so they're ready to go somewhere else. And so again, that says these kids, 11 and 12 and 13, that are getting disengaged, A, it's really essential for their lives that we intervene and get it right. But B, it's really essential for the community that we intervene and get it right, because those are, that is the engine of the underclass.
All right, I want to leap into the solutions and where you see them and what you think is happening in Baltimore as well, and in our areas here. But the one last thing I'm going to ask you about in terms of what you said, when you said how vital it is for kids that be promoted on time to the 10th grade, well, that's a huge indicator of kids leaving. But but you also say you don't have, we shouldn't have social promotions.
Right.
But so between the ideology that says ending social promotions and the understanding that kids have to go through 10th grade, there's a huge hole.
Right.
I mean, how do you address that?
And what that means is just really intensive, until it works, on time, right away intervention. So it means if a sixth grader, we don't wait to see if he grows out of it. We give them after school, Saturday school, summer school, tutors, mentors. We keep increasing the intensity until they're back on track. And we, or we keep changing the strategy until it works. And that's the only way around this dilemma, because it does nothing just to promote them. You're ignoring the problem if you do that. On the same token, if you hold them back, we know that there is A, no one angrier and almost no one with lower odds of graduating than an over age eighth grader. Again, if you're 16 years old and you're in a middle school, what you see is a bunch of babies. Until we get you out of that, you're not going to pay attention to anything, because you're just angry. You're sitting in little baby chairs, getting little baby books, and your friends are 2 years ahead of you in high school. So that tells us that just pure retention doesn't work either. So the only thing between that is intensive intervention, both early to prevent it and then right when we get the first signals until it's solved.
So let's talk about the intervention. Let's talk about what is being done and what has to be done at the moment. And talk about maybe what is happening in Baltimore and what needs more to happen.
Yeah. So one good thing about Baltimore is that we are paying attention to this chronic absenteeism attendance crisis, which again, as I said, is always sort of the canary in the coal mine and the signal that drives the dropout rate. And really for the first time, we have both the mayor and the superintendent, the CEO, and community people like Open Society and universities and grassroots groups have come together to create sort of a movement to get kids to come to school. And it's been a year-long process of both analysis, and we've been helping them with that to really locate where is the problem at elementary, middle, high, and what are the solutions. And you know, I think there's been some good – we'll see. This year will tell if it makes a difference. But at least there's been – a recognition that this is both a city problem, the mayor's got to be involved, and it's a school problem, and it's a community problem. And it's a measurable thing, right? We can know, are we getting our kids to school or not, right? It's not this abstract thing. Are we raising literacy achievement?
Figure out the tools to measure whether or not this is being successful.
Yes. And so I think that's a good first step forward, right? We have to see if it pays off. But I think it is a notable thing to say that our first step is to make sure our kids go to school every day and obviously to something worthwhile, right? Not just to be there, but to a worthwhile education. I think the other thing that's happening is there is a growing movement. The America's Promise Alliance has been trying to organize this nationally, which is Colin Powell's social action group, to really say that we need to bring the community together, because the community bears the cost of dropping out, the community being – and it's the permanent institutions, the universities, the businesses, the hospitals, the courts. They all pay the cost. They have to be involved in the solution. And also what's important about that is that they can work within the 5 to 10 year time frame we really need to really turn it around, because school systems are on a short clock. And if we just leave it as a school problem, every 3 years the superintendent is changing, and then we wait a year in between to figure out what the new plan is, that's not in the right cycle to solve anything. And so that's, I think, really why we've been arguing for this community-based approach, because the community stays there. So it can really stay the course for a longer-term solution.
So we have this attendance project, which is trying to locate the kids who do not attend and bring them back. We're doing the same thing when it comes to identifying the kids in the 6th and 9th grade and earlier who are not functioning and need intervention.
Yes. We're just working now on that analysis, and it's just about to be given to the school system.
So, and then from that, develop policies to address that.
Yes.
So talk, as we conclude, talk about what you think has to be done. So where does this lead us to really kind of
right.
end the crisis of dropouts and losing 500 kids a day?
Right.
Talk about what takes that down to a normal, whatever normal means in dropouts.
Right. Well, and we have to focus it so it doesn't seem overwhelming for folks is
right.
the first thing. So what we can say is we can actually locate the subset of schools where the problem is most severe. We can locate the transition point, sixth grade, ninth grade, into school, where it's the most critical time point. So first and foremost, we need to focus our efforts in the neediest schools at the most critical times. And then what we need to do is we need to really have sort of – it's actually a public health model, which is a three-tiered approach. We need to have upfront prevention, which says we know we're going to have an attendance problem, a behavior problem, and a kids behind problem. So we need good upfront strategies to get every kid to come every day to behave and to do well in their courses. We need that for all the kids in the school. The school's got to be organized on that premise. And there are some good research-based strategies to do that. Then we have to realize we have a subset of kids that are going to need essentially daily nagging and nurturing. They're going to need an adult or a near peer or someone every day to say, I expect you in school tomorrow, Mark. Mm-hmm. And if I don't see you, I'm going to come get you. And if I don't see you tomorrow, I actually do. So you know that. And did you get your homework done? No? Okay, let's meet at lunch and make sure you get that done. And you know, I saw you giving Mr. Jones a hard time. And I know he's sort of a tough guy, but that's not the way to deal with it. You know, you got to find a different way to work with Mr. Jones. And, oh, by the way, we're doing this killer after-school robotics program that I think you'd be perfect for. And I want you to come today with me as my guest. That took 10 seconds, but I needed to do that every day. And so we have to think of getting a second team of adults because a teacher can't do that for all the kids that need
right.
it. They can do it for a handful, but not – and then it's triage, and triage doesn't work. So we need to bring in national service volunteers. We need to bring in college kids doing work study. We need to bring in retired folks. We need to bring in folks from churches to create the second tier of adults targeted to this using sort of early warning systems to know who the kids are for the kids that just need that daily nagging and nurturing. And then we have to realize there's going to be a subset of kids that have real intensive problems that need to be case managed. They need a social worker until we solve the fact that they're being asked to be emergency daycare for their mom, for younger siblings, or they're the ones giving their insulin shot to their grandma because they have no one else's faith to do it. Until we solve that problem, that kid's not going to be in school every day. Or if we have a kid who's actually in ninth grade and truly has a second grade reading level, there is no group intervention that's going to solve that. That kid needs professional one-on-one high-impact literacy tutoring to close that gap quickly. And we have to be willing to invest the cost for this. This is costly one-on-one case managed. But the only way to make it work is to save that for the kids that nothing else works. First have our upfront prevention, our middle tier nagging and nurturing, and then sort of if that doesn't work, our case management. And we have to mobilize the community and the school to work together to provide those resources.
So I'd like to, in all this research you've done, and you do, and I mean, one of the things that I find from the things that you've written and that your team has written on dropout prevention is that you deeply believe that this problem is solvable.
Yes.
That we can make this work.
Yes, because we know, A, the kids want to graduate. That's important. The kids actually get it. They may be frustrated. They may do crazy things. They may for a while just say, I'm out of here. But fundamentally, they want to graduate. Two, we actually have good solutions for many of these problems. We just need to organize them at the scale needed. And we have to make sure they're in the places where the need is the greatest. And third, it's actually, we're making the case, it's in society's benefit. I mean, there is a high cost in the 21st century to large numbers of dropouts. Because there essentially is no work for them. And when there's no work for people, they go to the underground economy to make ends meet. And that perpetuates the crime and the teenage pregnancy and all sorts of things, which just sort of keeps this underclass going, which in a very competitive world, the nation can't afford at some level.
And it's interesting for me that you kind of epitomize in some a researcher who's involved.
Right.
Because a lot of researchers just
yes.
sits way over in a
yes.
corner and does the research, but
right.
you seem to be, and the people around you seem to be vitally engaged in
right.
how to make this research work and make social change.
Right. It's an idea of action research, that knowledge is only useful if we do something good with it.
Reverend Belfond, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for doing this for us today.
I enjoyed it.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ. Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. And over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered at WEAA by Zachary Coleman. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Brad Kalotner, and Devin Finley. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.